The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireyou. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And. My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Nir Eyal. Nir writes, consults, and teaches about the intersection of psychology, technology, and business. He is the author of the best-selling book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Nir founded two tech companies since 2003, and he has taught at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and the Hazo Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford. He blogs at nearandfar.com and is an active investor in habit-forming technologies. Some of his past investments include Eventbrite, Product Hunt, and Marco Polo. Nir, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a fantastic line early in your book, Hooked, that actually came from a blog reader who emailed you. In the book, you talk about the explosion of habit-forming technology and the likelihood that, quote, we are faced with a future where everything becomes potentially more habit-forming. But the blog reader said, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. And I find that to be a really simple way to sum up a very complicated subject of morality manipulation around these habit-forming products.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think you hit on the Trojan horse that I put in the book. The book is about how to build habit-forming products because the first goal of the book is to help people in the design community, in the product development community, people who want to be entrepreneurs and build great products that improve people's lives. You know, they buy the book because they want to build the next Facebook, and that's fantastic. That's really, you know, that's the first reason why I wrote the book. I started two tech companies myself, and I know how hard it is to build these type of products that can really move people. But the Trojan horse here, and the secret I'll reveal to you and your thousands of listeners, is that when you read the book, you realize, wait a minute, this is being done to me. That I'm also being influenced by these products and services. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, that was very intentional. The book is meant to kind of open your eyes so that not only can you build healthy habits through these technologies, which are miraculous in terms of their ability to change our lives, but also that we can stop and reflect and ask ourselves, wait a minute, does this technology I'm using, am I serving it or is it serving me?
Right. And, you know, this is a situation or a moral concern that I know Richard Thaler faced when he did Nudge and the idea of choice architecture, because people get kind of freaked out. But I mean, but the reality is it's going on already. And I love, again, this is why this quote, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. It is a superpower. And of course it can be used for evil, but that also means it can be used for good.
Right. And look, this is nothing new that you know, influence and manipulation is not something that was invented by Facebook and our iPhones. Influence and manipulation has been with the human species for millennia. And that's a good thing, right? We want to be able to quickly communicate information to people and change their decisions because we are a social species. And so influence is how we do that. Now, I think there's a very big difference between the two types of manipulation. I think manipulation and influence are neutral terms, but I think when you divide manipulation into two categories of persuasion and coercion, persuasion is when we influence people to do things they want to do, and I think that's the real power of these technologies and of these techniques is that, look, you know, the real problem is not that a few companies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Slack and WhatsApp, that a few companies have figured out how to influence. The real problem is that far too many companies and products and services out there don't hook us enough. right? That if you think about how hard it is to interact with your local government services or a restaurant down the street that you'd like to interact with all over your phone versus having to call them, or, you know, think about all the websites out there that are just so poorly designed.
Right.
These products don't suck us in, not in the way that, you know, Facebook and Twitter might. No, these products just plain old suck.
Right.
And so that's the real opportunity, and the real problem is that we don't apply these techniques enough. And I think the world could be a much better place if more companies could figure out how to hook us to eating better and exercising more and communicating with people we love more frequently and being more productive. There are ways we can use these techniques for good. Now, the opposite side of the spectrum is, of course, coercion. And coercion is about getting people to do things they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And that involves trickery. That involves the kind of things that after the user does that behavior that you've tricked them into doing, after you've coerced them into doing that behavior, they regret it. And that's the kind of dark patterns we don't want to see repeated and applied.
Yeah, that's like when my then 12-year-old daughter, we found out that she had spent like $300 on Farmville. And there was no getting the money back at all. And then conversely, some of the stuff that's popping up now, Countable is a kind of a cool app that I saw, like in light of everything going on in the election, that can give you ideas of what's being voted on and has really nice information that's right there for you. And then I was this weekend doing a keynote for a group, and the stage manager was showing me an app that he's got where like 15 of his friends are all working on their health. And this is an app that sort of talks about, were they exercising? Are they practicing meditation? Are they eating right? All that stuff. So, you know, it can work both ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the vast majority, I mean, look, the world is voting with their behaviors. I mean, the individual is telling us what they want in their lives. The fact that Facebook has, 1.5 billion users tells us that people, by and large, benefit from these technologies. And frankly, you know, I'm no Luddite. I live in the heart of Silicon Valley. I don't want to live in a world without these products. I love my iPhone. I love all the apps that I have access to, and I think they greatly improve my life. However, of course, you know, the dose makes the poison. And I think when we go overboard with these technologies, they can hurt us. And I think we're just now starting to get to that point where for the first time we're starting to take a step back and say, wait a minute, how much is too much and when is the appropriate use of these technologies? And that, frankly, is something we have done generation after generation. Every time there's a technological revolution, we realize, wait a minute, all these goods come with a certain number of bads, right? We had the agricultural revolution. We had this abundance in calories and food. The human species didn't have to starve anymore. But now, of course, more people die of diseases of abundance like obesity and diabetes than starvation. Then we had the Industrial Revolution, and we had all the amazing inventions of mechanization and combustion engine. Terrific. But now we have global warming. Mm-hmm. And I think the cost of the information age and the amazing miraculous technologies that we carry around with us on our phones every day, the cost of that is a price on our attention. You know, there's a reason we call it paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we're going to have to figure out how to manage.
Right. And you just talked about this in your blog, because you have a piece entitled How to Stay Informed Without Losing Your Mind. And you wrote that you've decided to give up consuming news online and kind of throw that out to people, which is a little weird coming from the tech guy.
Absolutely. And I got some amount of hate from people who are building websites that are trying to keep us sucked in.
Yep.
And the realization that I had was that look, just because the technology is new doesn't mean it's always better, at least not to every person. I'm not saying I don't want online news to exist, but what I realized that for myself, when I examined my own habits and behaviors, I realized that I was consuming online news, especially with the crazy election we just had and then the Trump presidency. There's always an attention-grabbing headline every single day, if not every single minute.
Yep.
And so what I realized was when I took a step back and said, wait a minute, what is this product doing for me, this online news I'm consuming? What is it for? Well, it's for staying informed and making sure I can be a good American citizen and participate in our democracy. But does that require me checking Twitter every 5 minutes? No, it really doesn't. What I want news to do is to give me the information and then leave me alone so I can live my life. Mm-hmm. And so online news wasn't doing that for me. I kept checking and checking and checking. And that's, of course, how it's designed to work. I know because I wrote the book on it.
Yeah.
So instead, what I did was I went back to the newspaper.
Yep.
So I still consume the news, but I consume in a format that I actually think is a technologically superior format for two reasons. One, the fact that I know the newspaper's coming to me every day relieves FOMO. Now, FOMO stands for fear of missing out. It's actually a real word in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as of a couple years ago. So I lose that FOMO. Why? Because I know that the paper that I get every day is going to have the information. I don't have to go searching and searching for it. I don't worry that I'm going to miss out on something. It's going to be in that paper, or it's probably not all that important.
Yeah.
The second thing I really like about the technology in the newspaper, and the reason I'm rehashing this is because I haven't subscribed to a newspaper in 15 years. And when I got the newspaper back, when I started subscribing again, I noticed that it can do something that the web can never do. It ends, right? So when you read the newspaper, you flip that last page, and it is the most satisfying feeling that you have finished the day's news. You're done. The internet never tells you, stop, you're done. You have enough information. But the newspaper implicitly, through this form factor, does. It says, good, you are well informed. Go about your day. And I love that.
Yeah. And two other things, which is one, it is not shallow news, which I think the bulk of those sort of like that when you're following your Twitter feed, you're getting sensational shallow news. It's not deep. This is reported stuff. And I think secondly, you're tending to your own psychological safety, which, you know, right now is, I think, the danger point for most of my friends on social media who, you know, it feels like when they put down the one pitchfork, they have to pick up the other pitchfork. And there's always a pitchfork. The brain just can't take it.
Right, right. And I think the sad thing is that it takes us away from what's really important. You know, what's really important in life is to spend time with people you care about, to do meaningful work, and to enjoy the tiny smidgen of time that we have on this planet to actually enjoy the life we have, as opposed to worrying and fretting about stuff, a lot of which we just can't do that much about. And so we should stay informed. But when it starts hurting us, when it starts becoming something that we become slaves to, I think it deserves a reassessment.
Yeah, yeah. Another blog that caught my attention was titled "The Way You Think About Willpower Is Hurting You." And this is about ego depletion. I'm wondering if you can describe what that is.
Yeah, so there's a popular notion kind of in the at large that willpower is a resource. So if you think about how we talk about our ability to resist temptation, you know, or our ability to do a difficult task, we run out of gas or we run out of steam we think that our ability to do something is something that we have in reserve. And in fact, there was a lot of research devoted to this line of thinking done by Roy Baumeister, was the man who wrote a book about willpower. And his whole hypothesis and the experiments he did were all around this idea that your ability to resist temptation or to do a difficult task works like a gas tank. And once that gas tank is empty, you're done. It's almost impossible to resist temptation. Well, it turns out that a lot of the studies that he conducted have been challenged by other psychologists, and those psychologists are having trouble replicating these studies. And so the whole theory of you running out of willpower turns out to not be as true as we thought, that in fact, this whole idea that you run out of energy, you run out of willpower, mental energy, that is, not physical energy, but mental energy, turns out to only be true if you think it's true. So so that has some pretty profound implications, right? When we think that, you know, you come home after work and you feel spent and you say, well, you know what, I've had a hard day, I deserve a Ben & Jerry's ice cream. That whole concept turns out to not really be true, at least not from any kind of scientific basis. It's only true if you believe you deserve a refill of your so-called willpower gas tank by indulging in something. And of course, by the way, marketers know that you think this. Marketers constantly market. If you think about ads for anything, you know, indulgent and savory, and if you think about the commercials and billboards, it's all about treat yourself, reward yourself, you deserve it. That's all playing into that this incorrect notion that we kind of run out of willpower.
Yeah, the idea there that belief drives the behavior, right?
Right, right. And I think that's an underappreciated element of how we can really improve ourselves, that there's a whole lot that's influenced by our belief. I study placebos as well, and nocebos. You know, there's the placebos that make us feel better, but there's also a similar effect to inert substances that can, because of the power of belief and expectations, can actually make us feel bad. And it turns out that this whole belief in a fixed amount of willpower turns out to be a nocebo. We perform worse when we think we've run out of gas.
Hmm. It's interesting, in our work in improvisation at Second City over many decades, our earliest classes are all about reorienting individuals' behaviors, usually in relation to a group, around things like, you're going to fail, so we're going to teach you how to fail fast, and you're going to mm-hmm. fail in abundance. It's almost like resiliency training, because you've got just so many things that don't work. And what you sort of develop over time is a muscle for getting back up. The sort of great, all those great people who come out of Second City all share not a gene, but they are practiced in the ability of, well, there's no reason to give up. I mean, like, yes, we're going to have like 100,000 terrible ideas, and that leads to the good idea. Keep going. And so I really think, right. You know, and this is the thing that we have a new partnership with the University of Chicago at the Booth School at the Center for Decision Research to study just this. So what is it about those sort of early improv exercises that might allow people to, you know, adapt their behaviors and in fact find that sort of inner, you know, power of will, I think is what you call it.
Right, right, right. And so when I study this stuff in terms of how it relates to technology habits or bad habits like eating things we don't want to eat or drinking too much of something we don't want to drink, it directly plays into this because, you know, people will, because of this notion of I'm spent and I you know, it gives me permission to take a break. And of course, part of that break involves, oh, let me have an extra cookie, or let me have an extra, yeah. let me just take a few minutes to check what's going on Facebook, because then I'll be re-energized. And that belief that you need something external, especially if it has to do with food, you know, I'm fascinated by this double whammy of, you know, take a break and have a Kit Kat or have a Snickers or whatever, and that's going to re-energize us. That's really embedded into the fabric of how we think about these products. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of that is influenced by the marketing of these products. But it's totally untrue, because then not only do we get the extra, you know, not only are we working off this myth that we're going to suddenly get re-energized, which is totally a placebo, but then we also get smacked with how bad the food itself actually is for us.
Yep, yep.
So it's a double whammy.
Let's talk about Hooked. In your book, you cite a paper by a Harvard professor, I think his name is John Gorville, that says, quote, many innovations fail because consumers irrationally overvalue the old, while companies irrationally overvalue the new. What's at play here with that?
Yeah, so this is all about the power of habits, meaning that many times the product that wins in the marketplace is not the best product. That we have, this is another one of our myths that, you know, that if my company just builds the best in market solution, that's good enough. Then I will surely carry the market. We're going to make a lot of money. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let me tell you, the Silicon Valley graveyards are full of technology companies that had the best product. It's not the best product that wins. It's the product that carries the monopoly of the mind, mm-hmm. the thing that we turn to first, that becomes the market leader. And I'll give you a couple of examples. If you think about Google, okay, mm-hmm. When I give a workshop or a talk, I'll often ask people, okay, how many of you in the room have searched with Google in the past 24 hours? And pretty much everybody's hands will go up.
Yep.
And then I say, how many of you have searched with Bing, the number two search engine? How many of you have searched with Bing in the past 24 hours? Maybe one hand mm-hmm. in a room of 100 plus people.
Yeah.
And so the perception is, well, Google just has a better product, right? Those geniuses in Mountain View have just figured out how to create better algorithms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that's wrong, that in head-to-head comparisons, when people look at the search results and the researchers stripped out the branding, meaning the users couldn't tell which one was Bing and which one was Google, and they just looked at the search results, people couldn't tell the two apart.
Hmm.
It was literally a 50-50 preference split. Some people did prefer one or the other, but in aggregate, it was 50-50. So what's going on? Why is it that so many more people, when it comes to the real world, outside of this laboratory study, what is it in the real world that makes people constantly go to Google when they need to search versus Bing? Well, the answer is it's just a habit. It's just because in our minds, when I'm searching for something and I have this internal trigger, what I call an internal trigger, to find this information, and I'm uncertain about where that information is, before I even have an ability to think rationally about, does my competitor have a better product or service? No, there's no time for that because I'm already on Google. And that's the power of habit, is that the power of habit becomes this competitive advantage because it squeezes out your competition in the customer's mind. It's just you and nobody else, even if that product isn't necessarily the best one in market.
I ran a video store in the 80s, and I was also a musician. And what I knew from both experiences is that beta tapes were better than VHS, no question. Terrific
example.
Yeah, beta died. I mean, and I don't know, and I still don't really know why. I mean, it had to do something with the ease of use. I looking back, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, it has to do with the network effect. That was a classic network effect story where it just became the industry standard.
Yeah.
That's a great example that the best technology doesn't win. It's the technology that captures the monopoly of the mind.
I thought this was a kind of a interesting corollary to the scholar at the University of Chicago, Nicholas Epley, has written extensively on how we overestimate our ability to understand other people. And one of his conclusions is that we just need to ask more questions. And you say the same thing. You say we need to ask why as many times as it takes to get an emotion. And I think that's fantastic because that is absolutely it. It's like, what's behind this? What's the pain point, the emotional pain point? That's what we're looking for.
Exactly. And that it's kind of a lesser understood phenomenon that human beings are actually not driven to seek pleasure. That if you think biologically, if you actually look at how the brain operates, the way that the reward system works, is that pleasure only operates to reinforce a behavior. But in fact, the reason we do things is because of the pain of wanting. The pain of desire. The way the nucleus accumbens in our reward systems and the dopamine loops in our brains work is not by creating euphoria, it's by creating this desire, this longing for something, and then that's why we do that behavior. And so you see in all sorts of products and services, this anticipatory response is brought about by some type of emotional pain. And so when I talk about in the book about how to design products and services that meet these pain points, it all starts by first understanding fundamentally what's the negative emotion. When I'm bored, I check YouTube. When I'm lonely, I check Facebook or maybe Tinder. When I'm uncertain, I go on Google. And it's that instantaneous association with these negative emotions, these painful, what I call internal triggers, that prompts us to habitual action.
I think most people totally get that with regard to their individual wants and that sort of pain point. But you extend that also to sort of groups. You talk about rewards of the tribe, and you say the need to feel social connectedness shapes our values and drives much of how we spend our time. What would be some examples of a rewards of the tribe?
Yeah, so this is a section of the book where I talk about variable rewards. And variable rewards are one of those things that once you see in the world, it's hard to unsee. And so variable rewards come from the research of B.F. Skinner, the father of operant conditioning. And he ran these really interesting experiments where he took pigeons and he put them in a little box and he gave them a disc to peck at. And every time they pecked at this disc, they would receive a reward, a little food pellet. And what Skinner observed was that he could train the pigeons to peck at the disc whenever they were hungry by giving the pellet in response to that behavior. So that's called operant conditioning. Terrific. He trained these pigeons to peck at the disc, get a reward. Great. But then Skinner did something a little different. Instead of giving the food pellet every time, he would give it just once in a while. So sometimes the pigeon would peck at the disc and no food pellet would come out. The next time the pigeon would peck at the disc, they would receive a reward. And what Skinner observed was that the rate of response, the number of times these pigeons pecked at the disc, increased when the reward was given on a variable schedule of reinforcement. Mm. Now, that happens in all sorts of species, not just pigeons. Of course, we are susceptible to this as well, that all sorts of things that we find engaging, that capture our attention and won't let go, you'll find these variable rewards time and time again. And they're split into these three categories, one of which you mentioned, rewards of the tribe, rewards of the hunt, and rewards of the self. So when we think about rewards of the tribe, this comes from our desire. You know, we're a social species, and, mm-hmm. and anything that reinforces our relationships that feels good, that comes from other people, and has this element of variability is a reward of the tribe. So when you think of what makes romance exciting, well, it's that uncertainty. Does she like me? What does she think? You know, there's this uncertainty about early romance. Of course, the more you know about somebody as the years pass by, it becomes less, you know, you get less of those butterflies in your stomach. It's less engaging because there's less unpredictability. Mm-hmm. When you think about competition, cooperation, all of these things have this social element of something variable that feels good. And then, of course, just to elaborate on that point, online where we see that, of course, is when you think about your newsfeed. Mm-hmm. On any kind of social media product, that list on Facebook, it might be your newsfeed, for example, that just goes on and on and on. It operates just like a slot machine. Now, every time you pull to refresh, that search for the next like, the next comment, the next interesting video, these are all forms of variable rewards that keep us checking and checking and checking.
Huh. I mentioned Farmville earlier, and I think your story about Zynga is really interesting because it's a great way to understand how incredibly successful you can be when looking at variable mm-hmm. rewards, but it's also how that power can actually be finite.
Right. Absolutely. So that's a great example. You know, there was a past few years, now it's kind of died down, but a few years ago, there was this big industry phenomenon that everybody was calling gamification, that we can take game-like mechanics of points and badges and leaderboards, and we're going to make all sorts of things super exciting. Well, it turns out that, you know, games are actually a really bad thing to try and emulate, because if you think about it, people don't actually play games for all that long. I mean, you know, nobody's playing Pac-Man anymore or Super Mario Brothers or, you know, Farmville. You mentioned Farmville or even Pokemon Go. Remember Pokemon Go a few months ago was going to take over the world. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens with those? Why aren't they engaging? They involve variable rewards. At first, it's very, you know, it's very novel. Where do I find my Pokemon? And then, you know, there's so much excitement over what's new and what's different and what's novel about these experiences. But then, of course, the more we play them, the more predictable they become. So Farmville is a great example, right? Zynga put out Farmville. Everybody in the world was playing Farmville, fastest growing game in history at the time. Mm-hmm. And then the next game after Farmville was Cityville, and then Chefville, and then Frontierville, and then Farmville 2. And it was the same game again and again and again. And what was once variable became predictable. So those are examples of products that have finite variability, where the more you engage with them, the more predictable they become. It's the difference between watching a movie and watching an improv show, right? You might watch an improv, you might come see an improv troupe every week, right? It's always going to be something new. There's always going to be something variable. But a movie, you know, as good as a movie is, you watch it once, maybe twice. You're not going to keep watching the movie again and again and again 100 times because you know what's going to happen. It's not interesting anymore after you know all the jokes and all the lines and all the, you know, the plot ending. So that's the big difference. It's finite versus infinite variability.
It's funny when you think about that and the fact that they just kept repeating themselves, you know, sort of over and over because they felt they had the one idea. And we get this all the time. And you touched on this in one of your blogs where you talked about what you do when someone steals your amazing idea. Because one of the things that's very true about the comedy business is that there's this never-ending obsession with joke stealing. And it never occurs to people that there are very good reasons why different people craft very similar jokes. And if you were – this is the thing we always say to our people. It's like, if you're holding on to, like, your one joke or your one idea for a movie and that's it, you're never actually going to make it in the industry at all. And you actually – I love this quote, holding ideas close to one's vest comes with unforeseen cost. Absolutely true. It gets away from the pre-marketplace of ideas. And improvisation in general is always a place where all this stuff is being shared. No one tries to own it. And they move on and they're very successful. And I think in part because they're not holding that stuff close to their vest.
Right, right. That they let that stuff go. You know who does this really well is Louis C.K. Right. Yeah. I think I heard that it's every year. Right. Every year he'll tear up his routine and just start fresh.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. that is not easy to do.
Yep. All right. So we're coming to the end of the podcast, and we ask every guest who comes on the show if they have a yes and story. So this is the sort of chief tenet of improvisation, the idea that you can't start a scene by saying no, and you can't start a scene by just saying yes. You have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if you have a moment in your life or your work where you were likely to say no, but instead you said yes and.
Yeah, so my yes and moment would be I started two tech companies, and after my last company was acquired, I asked myself this question of, you know, what do I want to do next? And I kind of had this crisis of not knowing where to go and what to do and, you know, where I should get a job. And I asked myself this question of what would I do if money was no object? And I kind of yes and that of, you know, mm-hmm. what? Yes, let me try that. Let me try looking at a question that I think is super important to me that I don't know all the answers to, but I want to research it. And let's see what happens with it. And it turns out that by just writing about something that I was very curious about, turns out that other people were also interested about it. And that actually became my next career.
Wow.
So the yes and was listening to what I would do if money was no object, and it turned out to be that could actually be a career in and of itself.
That's a great way to go. Nir Eyal, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.